Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Earlier, I was talking to Father Ambrose, and in fact, I was trying to explain to him this diagram, which I put here, and I'm afraid that not everyone can see it, but he did mention he thought that, you know, I explained it to him, and he says, well, it's useful, it'll be useful just for understanding exactly what I'll be arguing. So let me just explain what it says, what it's about. And for those that can't see it, it's just a circle, and then there's a sort of narrow arrow in the middle, which is marked N, and then on either side of it, there's not N, and then outside of the circle is P. Okay, the argument is this. Basically, a lot of what I'll be saying has to do with Prima Secundae 94.2, and which is the, you know, a famous article which speaks about inclinations, and in fact, it speaks explicitly about natural inclinations and the natural law. A lot of people use that article in order to just reduce ethics itself to inclinations and good, sometimes intention, et cetera, et cetera. But my argument is basically that in that article, Thomas identifies one very central type of inclination or group of inclinations, and those are the natural inclinations. And outside of those, there are other inclinations which are not natural, and yet they're still within reason. And then outside of reason, this circle is kind of reason, you in fact, then you find the passions. The interesting thing, in fact, towards the end of the talk, I hope I get to that, is that the passions, Thomas does say in Prima Secundae 24.1, I believe it, that the passions are not either good or bad, except insofar as they're connected with the intellect. That's basically the idea. In Prima Secundae 94.2, in fact, I'll just refer to this article as 94.2, that is the article which asks whether natural law contains plural precepts or only one, Thomas Aquinas speaks a good deal about what he calls natural inclinations. And indeed, it is easy to fall into a misreading of that article, according to which it is simply about inclinations. That is, inclinations, not necessarily natural inclinations. This misreading often emphasizes the non-rational or pre-rational character of the inclinations mentioned in the article, and so makes them difficult to distinguish from the passions. In this talk, I begin, that is in the first section, by discussing the foundation, or perhaps the foundations, of speculative reason, or sometimes called theoretical reason. Speculative reason being treated in the article as parallel to practical reason. And then in the second section, I discuss the parallel foundation or foundations of practical reason and the implications of this parallel for Thomas's understanding of what he calls the natural inclinations. In a following section, section 3, I look at a brief remark in Prima Secundae 94.2, also 94.2, which has often been misunderstood, arguing that a proper understanding of the remark supports the idea that 94.2 is primarily about law, and in particular about natural law, and not about anything non-rational or pre-rational. I also consider briefly Thomas's article, Secunda Secundae 64.7. That is another famous article which is much associated with the principle of double effect. And I'm not sure if I'll actually have time to get into that, but that has much more to do with actions itself. And then finally, I'll make a few remarks about how Thomas understands the relationship between natural inclinations and the passions. I leave, however, this topic to, that is, my fellows in this Thomistic circle, many of whom will be speaking about the passions. So, as I've already mentioned, 94.2 has to do with whether the natural law contains several precepts or only one. In fact, I insist that, you know, that we take seriously the title, that, and this is what it's about, law. Thomas's answer to this question is somewhat curious. As one, throughout the years, studies the Summa Theologiae, one comes to expect that Thomas's answer to such a question will be the opposite of the position articulated in the objections. This is not a hard and fast rule, but one does instinctively anticipate finding precisely that. But that is not what happens in 94.2. The objections do indeed all argue that natural law contains not plural precepts, but only one. And the corpus enumerates a number of precepts which are founded upon the first precept of the natural law. That is, the first precept being good is to be done and pursued and evil avoided. But the responses to the objections all argue that, in a sense, the objections were right. That is, that natural law is one. Here, for example, in the handout, this is number one, is the first objection in 94.2. It would seem that the natural law does not contain plural precepts, but only one. For law is contained in the genus of precept, as stated above. If, therefore, there were many precepts of the natural law, it would follow that there are also many natural laws. And here is Thomas's response, that is in number two on the handout. All these precepts of the law of nature, inasmuch as they are referred to one first precept, have the ratio of one natural law. The word ratio is a difficult one to translate into English, so I leave it untranslated. It might, for instance, be translated character, and Thomas would seem to be saying that the natural law or laws are plural. Although we can portray or depict natural law as singular. But that is not his point. He holds that the natural law is one. That is its proper intelligibility, even its essence. What this means, what it means to have the ratio of one natural law, becomes more evident in Thomas's invocation in the corpus of 94.2 of some Aristotelian ideas. The corpus begins with a discourse regarding principles understandable in themselves. Over the course of this argument, Thomas speaks of certain axiom, dignitates, or propositions, propositiones, that are, and I quote, understandable in themselves and commonly to all. Among these latter is the proposition that every whole is greater than its parts. He then says, and now this is text number three, among the things that are apprehended by all, a certain order is to be found. For that which falls first in apprehension is being, the understanding of which is included in all things, whatever one apprehends. And so the first indemonstrable principle is that affirming and negating are not done simultaneously, which principle is founded upon the ratio of being and not being, and upon this principle are founded all the other principles, as stated in Book 4 of the Metaphysics. Notable here is a sort of double foundation, although these two bases are intimately related. The two bases are, one, the first indemonstrable principle, that is the principle of non-contradiction, and two, the apprehension of being, or the apprehension of the ratio of being and of not being, since once one apprehends being, one understands that it is not being. The reference at the end of the quotation is to Metaphysics 4.3, and Thomas's commentary on this passage, which is connected to other Aristotelian remarks which Thomas knew quite well, sheds light upon what it is to be a natural inclination. He notes, first of all, that, and this is quotation 4, the intellect has a twofold activity, one by which it knows what something is, which is called the understanding of indivisibles, and another by means of which it combines and separates. So those are the two bases, really. By the first activity, he means the intellect's ability to grasp what something is, even before putting that singular grasp into a proposition. By the second activity, he means just such propositions, that is, propositions that either combine that thing with another concept or separate it from another, or it, in fact. Aristotle makes a related and even more relevant remark in the opening lines of De Anima 3.6. And actually, that place, that reference is important because it comes immediately after the very important De Anima 3.5, where he talks about the intellect. And in fact, these lines, the first lines in 3.6, come immediately after his mention of the passive intellect, which Thomas understands, and I accept his interpretation, not everyone does, in his interpretation that, in fact, the passive intellect is not, strictly speaking, intellect at all, but participates in the intellect. And that has a great deal to do, in my own mind, with the idea that the passions are not, strictly speaking, intellectual or part of reason, but they in fact can participate in reason and be connected with reason. And then a couple of lines later, he says, "For falsehood is always in combining." This is Aristotle. "For falsehood is always in combining. For even if one should say that white is not white, one has combined white and not white." To return then to Thomas's commentary on Metaphysics 4.3, that is the passage cited in 94.2, Thomas goes on there to argue that the primary, that is primum, of the two activities he has identified, that is to say to understanding of indivisibles and the combination and separation, is being. So that's primary, even with respect to both those principles. Being's primary character in the first activity is obvious. All thinking begins with the understanding of indivisibles. But in the second operation, being is also primary or basic, and this is quotation 6. And so the principle that is being is also by nature primary in the second activity of the intellect, that is the activity of combining and separating. So being is also there present, but by nature. And Thomas's expression there, that by nature, naturaliter, establishes an important link to 94.2. The passage in the Metaphysics, which Thomas cites in that article, is, of course, about speculative reason. But in 94.2, he identifies the same sort of alignment in practical reason, although in this case, instead of being, he speaks of good or even the good. And what he calls there, and this is quotation 7, the primary precept of law, commonly referred to as the first principle of practical reason, and that is that good is to be done and pursued and evil avoided. Maintaining the parallel with theoretical reason, Thomas speaks, in effect, of a double foundation in which one of the foundations, although intimately related to the other, is more basic. The more basic foundation is, of course, the direct apprehension of good or the good. The other is the primary precept of the law or the first principle of practical reason. In speaking of practical reason, Thomas continues to use language that puts good and the primary precept of law, or the first principle of practical reason, below everything else in practical reason. He uses, that is, the expression founded on, fundator sopra, and based upon this, super hoc fundator. But he combines that language with language that sees good as an end, and as what all things seek after or want. The good is conceived here not as something below the passions and the acts that constitute practical reason, but something above. And the natural inclinations are those inclinations that are headed towards the good up above. These inclinations, that is, the natural inclinations, are not the only inclinations that human beings have. They are rather the ones that correspond to the natural law. Or to be more precise, they correspond, or indeed are, the various precepts of the natural law that Thomas goes on to list, by virtue of which he can say that the natural law is one, but also plural. These are the precepts concerning the preservation of life, concerning procreation in the family, concerning knowledge of truth, especially truth about God, and also about living in society. But besides these natural inclinations, there are others that are incompatible with them. These exist because we are rational beings. Rational beings do have direct apprehension of being and beings, but as the principle of non-contradiction makes clear, they are also capable of asserting falsehoods, saying that what is not, or that what is not is. And similarly, humans are naturally oriented towards the good, but as the first principle of practical reason in effect acknowledges, they can also go towards evil. Good is to be done and pursued, and evil avoided. It is as if the soul of each human person, and this is where this diagram comes in, it is as if the soul of each human person was a body of water in motion, and that water has a natural tendency towards a point within the soul that is the good. Although it is also possible for sectors of that body of water, even large quantities of water, not to be headed in that direction. In 94.2, when speaking of natural inclinations, Thomas is speaking of water that is headed in the right direction. Sectors of water might be inclined in another direction, but these inclinations are not natural. Therefore, they're not part of the natural law. In a perfectly virtuous person, the soul's motion involves nothing contrary to the natural inclinations, the natural inclinations. In the less than virtuous person, there are movements contrary to that which is natural. A lot of these ideas, in fact, in the paper, at least as I've written it, I haven't mentioned this, but very similar ideas, almost the same ideas, come up when Thomas starts talking about synderesis and conscience. So, and synderesis is, in fact, you know, infallible. And I mean, we can talk about that too. But but synderesis is to be distinguished from conscience. So conscience is obviously connected with synderesis. That is which is in our. In fact, he says it's in the possible intellect, and that cannot be wrong. But conscience, in fact, can be wrong. Just as in speculative reason, it's one thing to apprehend being, but then it's another thing to start making propositions, making statements about being, and at that point you can be in error. Okay. But at this point I must issue a word of caution, that is caution regarding the topic of this conference. These other movements are not what Thomas has in mind when he speaks about passions. That is, I'm talking to you about the other movements, so there are, kind of natural inclinations, and then there are other inclinations, but those are all within reason. They're all, and he says this explicitly, they depend on reason and will, etc. Passions, as we'll see later, are outside that. Although, again, as I said, they can participate and be connected with reason and will. Thomas draws a parallel between the first principle of speculative reason and the first precept of practical reason. The first principle of speculative reason, the principle of non-contradiction, even if its basis is being, implicitly acknowledges that we can say and even think things that do not correspond to being. Such sayings and thoughts are actions of reason, for they involve propositions such as should be, but might not be true. In parallel fashion, the first principle of practical reason, good is to be done and pursued and evil avoided, although its basis is good, implicitly acknowledges that we might not follow that precept and so might, at least in particular actions, not incline towards the natural good. But this would be a deliberate action, not a passion. And passions are outside, that's why I put the passions outside that circle. That said, however, as both Aristotle and Thomas acknowledge, such actions might be impelled by passions, that is, actions which are actually human actions, deliberate actions. They might be impelled and affected by the passions. I shall come back to this idea later on. So now what I want to talk about is the idea that the precepts of the natural law are good. In the present section examined are two attempts to read 94.2 in a way that turns one's attention away from its positive regard for natural law as law. Both attempts concern the translation and so understanding of an admittedly dense or compacted sentence in the corpus. Immediately before this sentence, which we can call the compact sentence, Thomas makes the point expounded above. That is, that good is the basis of all levels of practical reason. And this is quotation 8. This is what he says before the compact or sentence. Now, as being is the first thing that falls under apprehension, simply speaking, and that word apprehension is very important. It's kind of direct apprehension, simpliciter, he says. So good is the first thing that falls under the apprehension of practical reason. We're not talking about combining things, but simply apprehension, which is directed to action. Since every agent acts for an end and under the aspect of good. And then he goes on to associate the first principle of practical reason with its basis, that is, good itself. And so the first principle of practical reason is one founded on the ratio of good, which is that good is that which all things want. This, therefore, is the first principle of law, that good is to be done and pursued and evil avoided. This association of good with a precept and so with law does not take Thomas's argument in the direction that certain commentators would like it to go. Those commentators, that is, who read 94.2 as primarily about inclinations and or about the particular goods towards which inclinations are directed. This line of thought influences their reading of this compact sentence, which we'll look at soon, immediately, which comes immediately after Thomas's mention of the first principle of law, or the first principle of practical reason. It's interesting that in fact, he does very, very often speak about the first principle of practical reason as the first principle of law. And again, that's emphasized that he's very interested in 9042, in law, okay, as opposed to, you know, inclinations in general. But anyhow, the Latin of the this compact sentence is number 9 on your handout. And I'll read it. It says, "Est super hoc fundantur omnia alia precepta legis naturae, ut silicet omnia ille facienda et vitanda pertineant ad precepta legis naturae, quae ratio pratica naturaliter apprehendet esse bona humana." And my own translation would run like this. "And on this, that is the first principle of law, are founded all the other principles of the law of nature. So that is, all those things that are to be done and avoided pertain to the precepts of the law of nature, which precepts practical reason apprehends naturally as human goods." So what he's saying is that precepts, which are laws, are the things that are good, if they're natural. You know. A number of things might be said about this sentence. First of all, as we have just seen, Thomas has associated just previously the first principle of practical reason with good. Here he does the same with respect to the plural precepts of the natural law, something he can do because they too are founded upon the good. And secondly, Thomas is speaking at the end here of apprehension and good, with no mention of evil, is consistent with his previously articulated association of good with practical reason's apprehension. Parallel as it is with his association of being with apprehension simply speaking. Apprehension is present before and is the basis, the basic basis of the joining and separating and engaged in by practical reason. The latter process involves propositions that can go wrong. Simple apprehension, the criterion of the naturally good, cannot go wrong. And again, that's synderesis. And third, Thomas specifies that these precepts, which practical reason apprehends naturally, are human goods, because he will go on to say that some of our inclinations, such as the inclination to preserve ourselves in being, are founded also in non-rational beings. It needs to be stated that this does not make these inclinations and their corresponding laws of nature any less human, nor does it make those inclinations as present in non-rational beings human, that our good inclinations are naturally human inclinations. So the translation by the English Dominican province, I issue my apologies here for criticizing this, but but I'm not sure how many members of the English province are here. But some of them, there's some good friends of mine in there. But anyhow, this is their translation of that compact sentence. All other precepts of the natural law are based on this, so that whatever the practical reason naturally apprehends as man's good or evil belongs to the precepts of the natural law as something to be done or avoided. One notices here a number of things. One notices, first of all, that the plural bona humana has been rendered in the singular, that is, man's good. This idea does correspond more or less to things that Thomas says, even here in 94.2. But by making the plural bona singular, the word can no longer correspond to its obvious referent, that is, the preceding plural precepts or precepta. Most noticeably, however, is the addition in the parentheses of the words or evil, which correspond to nothing in the Latin text. Moreover, this interpretation overlooks the fact that practical reason is said to apprehend naturally that certain things are good. Naturally oriented apprehension looks towards good and not towards not good, except accidentally. A more reasonable reading of the compact sentence understands Thomas to be saying that practical reason apprehends naturally as human goods the precepts of the law of nature. This idea is consistent with and nearly equivalent to saying that natural law is one, but also plural. And Germain Grisez offers another translation of the compact sentence, but a similar one. And this is number 11 on the handout. All other precepts of the law of nature are based on this one, that is, the first precept of law. In this way, that under precepts of law of nature come all those things to be done or things to be avoided, which practical reason naturally grasps as human goods or their opposites. It is apparent here that Grisez does not want to understand Thomas as saying that the precepts of law are human goods. Human goods being expressions Grisez employs later in the same article, while speaking rather of the objects of inclinations, that is, the natural goods or the basic goods. Accordingly, in his translation of 94.2, he associates the which of the final phrase, which practical reason naturally grasps as, with the things to be done or things to be avoided. This, however, presents a difficulty. Things to be avoided cannot be human goods. And so, similar to the English Dominican's translation, he appends to the words human goods the words or their opposites, which correspond to nothing in the text itself. I want to look at 64.7. So I mentioned that earlier, kind of secundae 64.7, which is often associated with the principle of double effect, because this, in fact, also shows the influence of natural law and what he says in 94.2 about natural law, how that affects individual acts. That laws are good things insofar as they are determinative of what might constitute a good human act becomes apparent in a close analysis of Thomas's Secundae 64.7. That well-known article is entitled Whether It Is Lawful Defending Oneself to Kill Someone, and is often regarded as the source of the principle of double effect. There are various ways of understanding the principle of double effect, but some of them read the article in a way similar to the way that 94.2 is sometimes read. That is, as having to do with inclinations quite independently of law or of laws. In this case, the inclinations become intentions. According to such an approach, whether one can morally kill another person, in particular an attacking person, depends upon one's intention, whether it is to kill the attacker, or rather to preserve one's own life. So it depends on the intention entirely. But a close reading of 64.7 reveals, however, that the intending to kill another person can be moral. That is, you can actually intend to kill, and that can be moral. That is, it can be within the law, depending on whether the situation is covered by a particular law. This is apparent even in the remark in 64.7 in which Thomas speaks of intention, and this is number 12 on the handout. He says this, "Nothing hinders their being of one act two effects, of which only one is intended and the other is beside the intention. Moral acts, however, receive their species according to that which is intended, not according to that which is beside the intention, praeter intentionem, since this is accidental." And so, from the act of defending oneself, two effects can follow, one the saving one's life, and the other the death of the aggressor. So that really suggests that, okay, everything depends on the intention, which, I mean, intention is very important even for understanding the law. But even this factor, that the intention to save one's life, that the intention is to save one's life, depends on what Thomas calls in 94.2 a natural inclination. And this is the continuation of quotation 12. Therefore, this act, since one's intention is to save one's own life, is not unlawful, seeing that it is natural to everything to keep itself in being as far as possible. And so an act of this type, because intended is the conservation of one's life, does not have the ratio of unlawfulness, since it is natural to whomever to conserve himself in being to the extent that is possible. One notices here the emphasis upon law. Thomas is referring back here to one of the subsidiary precepts mentioned in 94.2, that is the precept regarding the preservation of life, which I've already mentioned. I won't talk about, in fact, what he goes on to say in 64.7. I won't go into the details, but so you've got this first idea is that, you know, okay, what counts is, you know, that your intention is to preserve your own life, and it's only a side intention, a praeter intentionem, that the other person will die. But then he goes on to say that it is quite possible for someone who has public authority to intend to kill. And then he cites another law which permits that, an indication that not all depends on things independent of the law, that is inclinations and intention for the good, and et cetera, et cetera. But for rhetorical and philosophical reasons, it is important to state clearly that the terms law and laws, which I've been using a lot, that these terms do not refer to things imposed from without. As is, you know, apparent in 94.2, the pertinent laws or precepts are internal inclinations, internal natural inclinations that are determinative of whether a human person, can be acting morally. Both the Old and New Testaments speak of law as written on our hearts. And Thomas Aquinas, in responding to a suggestion that the natural law has not been promulgated, responds that it has been promulgated. And I quote, he says that the promulgation of the law of nature consists in the fact that God inserted into the minds of men that it might be known naturally. So it's not imposed, it's actually in our inclinations, but the natural inclinations. That said, however, the pertinent laws are still expressions of practical reason, and as such possess a certain authority over inclinations, understood more generally, over passions, and over intentions. Yeah, so I'll finish now just, you know, talking a bit about passions, okay. So what then can we say about the relationship between the natural inclinations and the passions? First of all, as I hope has become obvious, they are not all of the same type, okay? They're different types of things. The passions are good insofar as they are subject to the natural inclinations and so are headed in the same direction as they are. This is apparent in the last sentence, any passage which I didn't read actually. Thomas says that intending to kill is lawful as long as the intention is referred to the public good. But private animosity, says the word he uses is libido, however, it pushes that intention away from the public good and away from the authority of reason, that is, reason contained in law. So again, things depend on relationship with reason and law. This subjection of passion or passions to reason that is the right path, is spoken of throughout Thomas's discussion of the passions, that is, prima secundae, question 22 and forward. In the handout, I have included just one example, and that comes from prima secundae 24:1, the title of which is whether some passion of the soul is good or bad morally. And this is a quotation, number 14. Passions of the soul can be considered in two ways. In one way, in themselves, secundum se, and another way, according as they are subject to the command of reason and will, imperio rationis et voluntatis. If then they are considered in themselves, passions in themselves, that is, insofar as they are movements of irrational appetite, there is thus in them no moral good or evil, such as depends on reason, as stated above, that is, in prima secundae 18:5. If, however, they be considered as they are subject to the command of reason and will, moral good and evil is thus in them. And when he talks about will, of course, we have to bear in mind that he's talking about the lower appetites, or the appetitive part, insofar as it moves into reason and is working in together with that. So notable here is the emphasis upon the non-rational character of passions, and so their independence from moral good and evil, except insofar as they are subject to the command of reason and will, the latter being the appetitive power insofar as it joins with the intellect and reason. And again, at that point, reference can be made to De Anima 3:5, and then in that very final sentence, really, in 3:5, in which he talks about the passive intellect which participates in intellect. There are also other passages in Thomas in accordance which have to do with that passive intellect and its participating in reason, but I leave all these matters to the other participants in this Thomistic circle. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.